Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. So good to be with everybody as we do that coronavirus kind of lockdown thing, making the most of a new situation. Hope everybody is safe and well out there. Certainly you guys know where to find me on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn. We love it when you download. Don't forget to do the download on this one. I'm excited about today's conversation because this brother here is not only is he a political guru and campaign savant, but he's a little bit of a philosopher. If you've heard him from time to time on MSNBC, you know, he captivates you with the poetic, and it's a real pleasure to welcome him. Steve Schmidt, one of the most respected strategists and incisive voices in American politics today. Certainly, he's known widely for his senior roles advising President George W. Bush, presidential candidate Senator John McCain, may he rest in peace, and California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. But a lot of folks didn't know that Steve had his hand in the success of Governor Schwarzenegger. He is the former vice chair at the public relations firm Edelman. And in 2018, unfortunately, I have to say this, he renounced the Republican Party. But Steve, I'm like a Motel 6, baby. I got the porch light on for you. So, you know, it'll be all good. You can come back, man. How you doing? Welcome to the podcast.
I'm good, Governor. It's good to be with you. How are you?
I'm good, man. We're doing well. Life and limb is holding up. Family still talks to me despite isolation alone with me here in the house. Mm-hmm. But we're doing well. How's your family? Everybody's good?
Everyone's good. Everyone's good. You find out where you stand in the pecking order
very quickly, don't you?
In times like this, and you know, it's stiff neck from looking up.
Absolutely. Well, I'm glad you made it by, man. I know there's a lot going on, and you know, I don't know about you, but I find I do more meetings now per day than I used to do all week. It's been a crazy space with Zoom and all this stuff, man. Everybody's like, yeah, let's do a Zoom at 7 p.m. I'm like, dude, 7 p.m.? Are you kidding me?
It is a strange time. Here in the early days of the third decade of the 21st century, it's an epic moment. It's the biggest moment, I think, in our lifetimes. And I think that it may be one of the most enormous moments in the history of the country. The Civil War, the Second World War, as grave as these challenges and events were, and I don't mean to diminish them in any sense, because I think they are the two great defining events, along with the Revolution and the country's history, but they didn't completely end American life in the way that this has temporarily. It shuttered fundamentally the entire country, and we are deep in uncharted territory. The delusional reality show that we see play out every evening is just such a profound disservice to the country, because you know, the reality is that we're very much closer to the beginning of this than the end. And the fact is the economy is not going to be recovered and firing in June or in August. It's not going to be back to normal in June or in the fall, and it's going to come back in the fall. And the happy talk and is doing a great disservice, I think, to the country as we, you know, look in the early hours of what's a profound national crisis with a leader who is so profoundly unfit to lead the country out of it that you really don't even know where to begin to start to describe it. And the mystification, frankly, that anybody could look at the performance and to see what he does up there every night between the indecision, how erratic he is, the incompetence, the ineptitude, and say, geez, you know, this is someone who's got his hands on the ball here, right? You know, I'm comfortable following him. I trust him. And so I get that, you know, in a nation with two parties, two choices, that, you know, in a tribalized country, people look at it, they say, I'm on one team, that's the other team. You know, I may not like that guy, but he's on my team. But now the stakes for the country, as we think about how we're going to recover from this, and the magnitude of the unemployment, the economic suffering, the bankruptcies, all of it, the insolvencies to come. You know, it's just, you know, we're at an hour, Michael, where, you know, the president is as manifestly unfit as a human being could possibly be in a moment of life and death crisis like the one we're in.
Yeah, you hit on a number, I think, of important points at this juncture, and I want to stay a little bit in the philosophical space for a moment, because I think it really speaks to some important questions that as Americans we have to ask ourselves. I was having a conversation the other day, and I pointed out that for me, a lot of this is now really reflecting back on us and how we then reflected back as a nation. In other words, what are we looking for as Americans, as citizens? What kind of government do we want? What kind of leaders do we want to lead that government, particularly when we see now in such stark relief the difference between a president Trump and a president, Obama's an easy one. I want to talk about Obama and a president Bush, for example. Both gentlemen dealing with crises, different types for sure, but philosophically, how they came into their leadership at a crisis moment, where the president took the nation to President Bush took the nation to a different spot. When he's standing there on that mound, what's the remnants of the towers with the American flag and a fireman and the American people resolute. And here with Trump, you've got him in the conference room sort of waxing about how put upon he is to actually have to provide help and services to the states to deal with the virus. How does that work in your view philosophically for the American people? What do you think they're seeing? Because the polling now is saying they're falling off of this idea that he's handling this well. So is it like Joe Scarborough said on the Morning Joe this morning, that, you know, there seems to be this moment where the American people are of one thought now about this virus, where they, no, we want to stay at home. We think that's the safe thing to do. No, we want to see more testing, and we trust our governors to do that. Philosophically, and I guess that kind of leads into the politics, where do you think the American people are coming down on all of this?
Well, he's being illuminated by reality. Mm-hmm. And what he's been able to do through a combination of factors, right, which is the vast propaganda network that surrounds his political organization, that envelops his presidency, which is really a business of self-interest, not national interest, right, where unlike all of the men you named, from Jimmy Carter to George Bush to Bill Clinton to Barack Obama, Dwight Eisenhower, every one of them, agree with them, disagree with them, what they understood is that they were the leader of the American nation, they were the commander-in-chief, the head of state, the president of the United States, and that included the people who didn't vote for them. And they were all called upon to show the qualities that were once ascribed to Lincoln of greatness and goodness. And it's not that just that Trump has an incapacity intellectually, organizationally, really mentally, I believe, but morally in this dimension. And we see this manifest itself when the President of the United States stands behind the podium emblazoned with the seal of the President of the United States of America from the White House when there's 50,000 dead Americans, and he talks about his ratings. And so the American people see this, and they see the profound deficiency in character. And they understand that if you're a small business person, that in fact, these programs aren't working. The loans aren't accessible. And wait until we see the full extent of the waste, fraud, and abuse of the $2 trillion that went out the door.
Right.
And let's be clear, as two people, I think, who were Republicans chiefly because we're fiscal conservatives, the era of, hey, I'm a limited government conservative. I mean, I think it's stripped of any meaning in a month where government can spend $2 trillion.
Right.
I don't know what any of that means anymore.
But no idea.
But not to digress from the main point. Right. This is an office where character matters, and there's consequences to elections. And to the larger point that Churchill observed, in a democracy, people get the government they deserve. Or our founders, who never conceived of the republic being able to function absent an informed and engaged citizenry. And so what we see over a period of months, and you look at, for example, Laura Ingraham or Judge Jeanine on Fox, and the lunacy coming out of these people's mouths, the lunacy of these protests around the country where people are going to get sick and people are going to die, the accumulation of all of the vices of the Trump era playing out at this decisive moment right now, where the question will become, as we move now structurally to unemployment rates significantly north of 10%, 25 million people unemployed. I don't know in the real world, but the $1,200 isn't going to sustain families for very long.
Right.
And so there's going to need to be profound creativity with regard to mortgage payments, or we're going to have a default crisis that will lay out over years. And this time, as we watch, right, the gilded class who sits at home, while the courage class saves lives and operates the economy, is not going to stand for it, right? That the gilded class is insulated and gets all the economic upside of this, while the courage class is economically decimated and pushed down into the despairing class in this country, where we see, you know, 50,000 people a year dying of opioid overdoses,
right,
or the suicide epidemic, and all the worsening pathologies that we also see and don't talk enough about in the early hours of this crisis, such as the worsening domestic abuse situation,
right,
or a child abuse situation, and how much harder this impacts those forgotten populations that are so necessary, you know, in reality, as we see, to the functioning of American life.
So how do you explain, and I love the visual, you know, of the gilded class and versus, you know, basically that working class, that individual who's out there, who's protecting, you know, and working and taking the risk. How do you then explain the numbnuts who, as we see now, appearing in state capitals like Wisconsin, my state capital here in Annapolis, Maryland, showing up, protesting, and saying, you know, we want our freedom back, and we've got, you know, got my Confederate flag and the American flag, and I'm ready. Oh, by the way, I got my AK on my back, and I'm now ready to go back to the massage parlor. What the hell is that? And how do we reconcile that in the face of everything else that we have to deal with? Because the country is not ready to open, and it won't be for at least another couple of months on a good tip, because the testing isn't in place. We have no idea who's carrying this damn disease, who's infected by it, who's potentially infected by it. How do we now, in this new space that's been created by the president, we got to liberate Wisconsin. How do we deal with that? Because these clashes of culture and truth and reality are just as harmful as anything else.
Yeah, I think so. I think that this is a multi-part answer, and I think you raise a couple of important issues. But let's talk about the concept of crazy people, right? Which we don't tend to talk enough about, right? In all of this, and I mean that seriously.
Yeah, I'm with you.
So I remember as a kid. In North Plainfield, New Jersey, growing up, we would go, the Acme supermarket was the store, and was conscious of a young age of the Lyndon LaRouche guys and women there handing out the Lyndon LaRouche pamphlets and chasing you across the parking lot.
Right.
And I remember saying to my dad, like, what's that person doing? And my dad just looked at me, he said, well, it's a whack job. I said, okay.
Uh-huh.
Right. You know, kind of got it, right? You know, crazy person, you know, out, you know, screaming, you know, and they should have the right to do it, but screaming about whatever on, you know, from the park bench, whatever.
Right.
We've always had about 30% of the country's always been crazy. Right? It's always been, right?
True.
So it's a constant, right? There's not more crazy people in the Trump era. It's just easier for them to all connect to each other with a leader atop in a communication infrastructure that allows for their connection, right?
Yeah.
But crazy they are.
Right.
And be clear about this, right? So this is zero sum, right? As we head into an election less than 200 days a year, right? So Laura Ingraham goes on to Twitter and she says, and remarks, she says, well, I wonder if all the people who talked about liberating Iraq and Iran and Libya and other, if they will like scream as loudly, whatever she said, to liberate Virginia and California,
yes,
and everything. Right.
Yes.
And, you know, and here's the bottom line, right? She's fucking nuts. and people, right. Like Judge Jeanine, she is too. And a lot of people on that network are just nuts. And so what we have to decide as a country, right? And this is as former Republicans, and it's why I'm going to vote for Joe Biden.
Right.
Right. And it's this, right? I want those people as far from political power in this country as possible. I want them to have as little influence as possible. And all of those people, by and large, support Trump.
Right, right.
Right, who fuels these crazy protests where people will get killed. Now, the second part of this, right, and there's a media component to this, and there's a American life component to it. I understand that when you look at the aerial shots of these protests, that it's like 300 people. And you can film it on the ground and make it look like that it's 500,000 people. But I'm going to be 50 years old. I'm 49.
Mm-hmm.
Since when in America do we see political protest manifest itself with the appearance of dozens of men in the back of army vehicles, armed to the teeth with semi-automatic weapons and face masks all over the country, and not have a collective moment of, holy shit, this isn't good?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Right? This looks like a scene out of The Handmaid's Tales. And forget about, and I'm a gun owner, and I'm a believer in the Second Amendment. But having a right to own a firearm and appearing with it on the front of the state capitol, dressed like you're an extra from the early days of The Handmaid's Tales, it's terrifying.
It is terrifying.
And number three, I think it is incredibly important for the media both to cover this, but to cover it in the perspective of what the actual numbers are, and that shows it from a vantage point that can give people the proper perspective. because the last thing you want to do is fuel that there is momentum behind some right. type of armed insurrectionist moment in a moment of national crisis. And I'll say this lastly. The Great Depression, right, and FDR, who I think is the great leader of the 20th century globally, saves the world for democracy, but he saved democracy in America. And I think the point a lot of conservatives miss about the New Deal isn't that you can just look at it through an economic analysis. Did that program work? What those programs did in total is restore faith in the system and American democracy at a moment where you were seeing the collapse of democracies in places like Germany and Italy and the rise of fascism, rise of communism, rise of all sorts of authoritarian movements all over right. the world, right? A right. spike of nationalism. You know, he preserved, right, democracy. And right. so, right, when, you know, through optimism and activism on the part of government. And the point being is Trump is no FDR.
Right.
Right. So this is a dangerous moment. When you combine the people on the front lawns with automatic weapons, the reality that you're looking at on television and you're seeing food lines, right, for people, right, who are forced through, you know, these circumstances, hardworking people, right, people of dignity, people who, like, want to work, right, we're working, right, who all of a sudden are relying on handouts and they're running out of food and people are hungry and don't have money. We're at a dangerous moment by circumstance that's going to get a lot worse before it gets better with a leader in that position who's so manifestly unfit for the task and has no capacity to lead us out of what will have to be a recovery that takes part and plays out over multiple administrations. Because it's going to take a lot longer to turn the American economy back on than it did to turn it off.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that then becomes, for me, an important question. So what do Americans do? Should they, how do we respond to what we see happening in these what I call coronavirus press rallies every day? You know, should they be concerned about the president ousting doctors like Dr. Bright and discounting the legitimate research and medical, perspectives of a Fauci or Dr. Bricks, trying to, as we saw just recently, trying to browbeat them into accepting his gut feeling that this virus is never coming back. And Dr. Fauci is like, dude, we're going to have COVID-19 come the fall. It's going to be here. So as Americans watching this shit show happen every day for 2 friggin' hours, and trust me, folks, a whole lot of shots because that's the only way I can do it. What do we do? I mean, do we like suffer through this until the ballot in November? Because what has surprised me, Steve, is that we have not seen the kind of public response a la protests that we probably would have seen in any other administration or certainly a generation ago, if a president acted with such disregard for the general welfare of the American people, let alone its institutions. So what do we do then? What should our response be?
I'm gonna say this. I don't know what the reaction's gonna be. I may get us both in trouble. To me, this is not an hour that requires protest. It's an hour that requires attentiveness and presence. Watch that briefing. Watch it. And the idea that it wouldn't be aired because he lies, I think, is so profoundly wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't disagree with it more. This is real life. This is happening. Like, there is no fucking trigger warning.
Right.
Right? These are 50,000 Americans are dead. Tens and tens of thousands of more are going to die. This is somebody who said that on 15 different occasions, the Chinese government was doing a great job. There were 15 cases here. Soon it would disappear like magic. And now he's talking the same level of bullshit that he talked in the beginning of February. And the result of that will be more death, suffering, and economic collapse. But people know what leadership fitness looks like. And so I think that America's families, right, in the context of their living rooms, and I say this without judgment for anyone who voted for them.
Right.
Let this be the end of the reality show era of American politics.
Yeah, I'm there.
Right? There has to be, with the election to officials in high office, people who have the capacity to function in a crisis and get the job done. I don't care if they have a D next to their name, like Andrew Cuomo,
mm-hmm,
or Gavin Newsom, or an R next to their name, like Charlie Baker or Larry Hogan,
yep,
or Mike DeWine. Competence. And so I think it's a moment for the American people to understand that by the narrowest of margins, the host of The Apprentice became the president of the United States and set that out for 3 years, creating chaos, dividing the country, defiling his office, lying to the American people until it happened. And there was a real lack of imagination, I think, in the American mind about the capacity for tragedy and the relevancy of who sits in that office behind the Resolute desk. Because the truth is, there's a lot of people, a lot of those Obama-Trump voters who look at this, and they know
mm-hmm,
this wouldn't have happened like this if Hillary Clinton was the president, or Barack Obama was the president, or if George Bush or Ronald Reagan or Jimmy Carter was the president.
Yeah.
They sit and they watch in astonishment when somebody talks about their ratings. It's 50,000 dead Americans. The unfitness is branded on his forehead under the Klieg lights of the stage of his vile imagination, where this is some type of opportunity to play a role and to be adulated by his fan base.
That's it.
It is the most despicable quality of character you could possibly see exposed when the country requires leadership.
I mean, it's just the sheer lack of interest in anything remotely close to empathy and understanding what's happening out there across this country is something that's been profoundly jarring for, I know, a lot of folks I talk to and for me personally. And so I really wrap my head around what you just said, because I think I agree with you. I don't think I know. I agree with you. On the fact that it needs to be seen. This is a moment where it's fully exposed. It is raw. And you get to see real time exactly what's going on. Yeah, put your shot glass next to you. And you may have to go back two or three times. But sit there and watch the shit unfold in front of your eyes. Because then you can get to answer that question, what kind of leader do you want leading this country?
And when we're talking to our friends, right, and we're talking to our family members, and we're talking to our former colleagues, mm-hmm, right, to be able to, why is it okay for him to lie to you?
Right.
Right. There are no tests. There is no equipment. These programs aren't functioning. That's the truth.
Yeah, it's not. They're not. And you can see it on the faces of the people standing up there, whether it's in this coronavirus situation or whether it's on an immigration matter or a healthcare matter. The backdrop, the scenery that he puts around him. I used to tweet out to people when we were having these other pressers. I would say, don't pay attention to Trump. Look at the faces of the people behind him. Because that's when you get to know, oh, yeah, they're not buying into shit. But they are forced to stand there. That's the reality.
You know, absolutely. I mean, they're hostages on the front lines in our collective national imprisonment. You know, all of us now somehow trapped inside, right, watching, you know, Trump's reality show.
Yeah.
as captive audience. And it's like the most malign or malevolent dream. I mean, it's like, you know, you can almost picture Don Jr. saying, Dad, if you could have three wishes, right, one of the wishes being, you know, that I would love to make all the people captive so they could watch my reality show.
But we're there. We're stuck there. You can't change the channel. You cannot change the channel. I one of the last speeches I gave pre-coronavirus was to a group of about 700 people, and I asked the audience, I said, look, how many of you got up this morning and the first part of your conversation with your spouse, your lover, whomever, was about Donald Trump? And half the hands in the room went up. I was like, can you imagine? You get out of the bed talking about this guy. You go to bed talking about this. I mean, this is the complete permutation of your life by Trump and Trumpism. That's unnatural. I mean, we've had 44 presidents before him, and on any given day, you barely mention one of them prior to Trump.
100%. I think, look, it's not normal, right? Like in a healthy democracy, you just don't have the leader omnipresent at the front of your brain. In
all
the recesses
time.
Of your mind, at the top of your nightmares, like, you know, all of the time in it. But, you know, here we are. And, you know, the reality is that, you know, the only way to get rid of them is in the election in November. And if you look at the polls in the states right now, you know, the degree to which, you know, he's out there, it's pulling them down.
Yeah.
And I think that's terrific, because there's no scenario by which we see him gone, you know, before about, you know, 200 days from now, an election, a little bit less, and then, you know, the months later, an inauguration. And that's what the deal is on that. That's just reality. So take it in. This is the president of the United States, and to understand the consequences of this, right? This is, you know, I think we're across the line. You know, we're at the end of the era,
right,
of the U.S.-led liberal global order that existed from the end of World War II, that was architected by FDR, built by Truman, maintenanced, you know, by presidents from Eisenhower then through Obama. It's over. And, you know, whatever comes next in the world, it'll be different. It will not be a world that is looking to American leadership in the way that it used to. There'll be more nationalism, more populism. There'll be more rescission in democratic governance around the world. And we're going to see profound instability that results from this event in a lot of places around the world over the next year, over the next couple of years. And the country is saddled now with somebody who possesses literally none of the virtues of greatness that are called forward in these times.
Mm-hmm.
Possesses none of them. And that's tragic for this country. Because the American people have never so profoundly made the wrong choice as that was made in November of 16. And, you know, we're gonna pay an awful price for the incompetence and the ineptitude of it.
Do you see? Do you think they see it that way? Do you think they've? Do you think that they've see that there was a choice, a bad choice made here? Because I'm still dubious about the unelectability of Donald Trump. I still think that. We could wake up and people go, what the fuck? What?
No, 100%. I mean, we haven't talked about politics, you know, of all of this. But, you know, I think that there's two key political issues you look at, right? You see him trying to get to the front of the line, trying to blame China. And then you see, well, Trump's attacking China. And I see too many Democrats on TV taking a line then that's too soft on China. You know, the Chinese culpability in this is immense.
Yeah.
We ought to talk honestly about that. Two things can be true, right? Trump's lying to America. The Chinese lie to everybody.
Right.
Right. Both true.
Both true. Very
and,
true.
And the second thing is, you know, Trump is stating, you know, what's obvious to everyone at some point, you know, we can't all stay at home forever. Right. You know, hey, it's going to be June. It's going to be July. You know, at some point. Right. People are going to start to react to this stuff through the prism that airline passengers do. And I know you fly about as much as I do, mm-hmm. you know, that there's nothing that pisses you off conceivably in all the world when that moment where they tell you it's 10 more minutes, 10 more minutes, 10 more minutes. And, you know, it's not right.
Right. Right.
You know that that flight's going to be canceled. And you sit there and you're like, why the fuck are they lying to me?
Right. Just tell right? me you canceled the damn flight.
Like, why? Right. I know that you know that I know that it's not going anywhere.
Right.
So the whole, hey, 3 more weeks, 1 more month, 2 more months, you got to stay inside till September. Parks are closed. Beaches are closed. Right. All people, right, at the end of this, right, like, we'll look at this and this will become who can get us back the fastest, right. Right? Who can recover the economy, right? And Trump, right, nobody can say that guy doesn't want to reopen the economy as fast as possible.
Right.
So Democrats need to make the point that what will happen is what has already happened, which is the combination of delusion and happy talk and incompetence will cause more people to die and will retard the opening of the economy and increase the magnitude of economic suffering.
Bingo. I mean, that's it. I mean, that's basically the counter response narrative to what we see right now, because that seems to be the energy that Trump is trying to recapture. Is the economy was great and I'm going to make it great again, but we got to open it first. So we need to open it yesterday. And everybody's like, okay, because now I'm 4 weeks, 5 weeks without a job, a paycheck, et cetera. And that narrative can take hold, but there's got to be a sobering thought that comes from someplace else to help people refocus why this has to play out differently than the way Trump is talking about, I would think. And I think that's one of the challenges that the Democrats are going to face in this election. I mean, to your earlier point, I always looked at Biden, which is why I pegged him as the nominee a year ago and was very resolute about it. Even when he went through that crazy period where it was like, oh, I'm Joe Biden. It was still, you know, I was like, no, this guy's going to be the nominee, because at the end of the day, this election will not be about the future of the economy or the country or the Democratic Party. It will be about who can get us off crazy and who can be that sobering leader who understands what we're going to have to do on the other side of this. But you still have to make that case up front. And I think that's going to be an interesting challenge for Democrats. I love what you said. Trump lies to America. The Chinese lie to everybody. And I think, yeah, that's a twofer. And it really encapsulates, I think, a lot of the concerns, the legitimate concerns that people have. So make that case. Make that point. Right?
The persuasion argument here has to be not to the crazy people.
Right. Yeah, right.
But to the people that look at the crazy people and look at their opponents in the other party and say, but, well, most of these crazy people are on my side or have been traditionally. The argument you got to make is, No, they're crazy people. You don't belong with the crazy people. You belong with these people over here. They're all the normal people. Right?
Why do you want to hang with crazy?
Those people with the guns on the front of them. We want to do that. We're gonna have to do a lot of that. It's gonna persuade. I said, oh, those aren't your people anymore.
Yeah, because you can support the Second Amendment, but not have to show up on the front lawn of somebody's house with an AK-47.
No, shit, you know. You're going to get your Jason mask on and your AK-47 and go to the state capitol. Then come on. Right. When is that okay?
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So, well, Steve, I think we, at least I know, but I really hope my listeners understand and appreciate why you're such a respected strategist and certainly an incisive voice in American politics today. I know it's so funny. You took a little break from television for a bit when you were doing some other things politically and otherwise, and I would get emails and tweets from people asking, so When is Steve coming back on MSNBC? Where is Steve? Oh. And I shot you a note the day your first day back and say, hey, welcome back to the family, man. It's your voice was missed.
Good to be back.
We're glad you're back. Keep that voice strong and loud out there. I think it's something America needs to hear, because while we can get lost and consumed by the politics, you help put it in context and understand a connection to something bigger than the political moment that has important consequences for the future of the country. And you have a very, very good way of articulating that. And I think it's something that a lot of people appreciate. And I appreciate personally your coming on and sharing it with my listeners, man. I really do.
You got it. Good to be with you, Governor.
Absolutely. So, folks, that's the incomparable Steve Schmidt. Such a pleasure having him. Don't forget to do that download thing. You know where to find me, Apple, Stitcher, all those good places. We love the downloads. Why don't you also check out, rating us every once in a while. That's always good, too. But it's great having you guys take a little time in your coronavirus world to step into the Michael Steele podcast for just a little bit of respite from it all. Catch us next time. We'll be back with more fun. Catch you later.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to lostgolfballs.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. lostgolfballs.com.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.